Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. In today's episode, I'll be discussing the new Netflix series, Ripley, based on the classic Patricia Highsmith novel, newly available on Netflix. First, I'm going to give you some background on the project, on Highsmith herself, on the history of this book, which has been adapted multiple times. And after getting that introductory content out of the way, I'll be discussing with Sona the first three episodes of the series. And in that section, we will begin with no spoilers at all, and then spoil the first three episodes, and only the first three episodes, which is all that she has seen. However, I have seen the entire thing, and then after that segment of the conversation, I'll be solo again, talking about not only the remainder of the series, how I appreciated the show more as it went along. So I wasn't fully engaged in those first three episodes, but I actually very much did enjoy the series by the conclusion, and I'll get into all those thoughts. Plus, along the way, as I break all of that down, I will also be discussing the previous adaptations of this very book, the Ripley character in general, and of course, many recommendations along the way as we touch on these different topics. All right, to kick things off, this series, directed by and written by Steve Zaillian, was actually originally produced for Showtime, and you'll see it at the very beginning title sequence of the series that it is a Showtime production. And if you are longtime listeners of this podcast, you would know that when Sona and I began discussing shows on here, one of the first things I mentioned to her is that, hey, we should watch that Ripley show when it finally comes to Showtime. And we brought that up because, I'll get into this, but the legacy of this work itself, you think about all these charming, esoteric sociopaths that are so popular in the movies and series of today, they all harken back really to this Tom Ripley character. But as I mentioned, this was in production in 2019, maybe, perhaps before the pandemic even. I'm not sure exactly of the dates. But then it was supposed to air back in 2020, and then it was delayed and delayed. And then eventually Netflix acquired it, which I actually at the time thought was a good idea because of the series You, one of the most successful Netflix series, heavily indebted to the Ripley character. And Netflix, using its algorithm, could easily plug the trailers for this series in front of everybody who'd watched You, which is quite a large number of people. So a little bit about Steve Zaillian. First of all, Sona and I have also discussed this on the podcast here as a recommendation. One of the most recent things he had done before producing this series was the absolutely excellent, really highly recommended, you must track this series down if you have HBO or Max, the one for HBO, a series called The Night Of, which is an adaptation, another adaptation of a British crime procedural, but just one of the very best series I've seen in the past 5 to 10 years. Definitely track that down. He began all the way back in the 1990s writing and directing a film called Searching for Bobby Fischer. He is more famous as a screenwriter for other directors, and this is just some of the incredible screenplays he's been involved with. Schindler's List, just a little film called Schindler's List, the original Mission Impossible, Hannibal, the adaptation of the Hannibal Lecter novel, Moneyball, excellent screenplay for Moneyball, the U.S. version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and multiple Martin Scorsese movies, including The Irishman, also a Netflix production from a few years back. Excellent script there as well. And he has directed here and there as well, directed, just to name a few, the Bobby Fischer movie, as I mentioned, A Civil Action, the film adaptation of the nonfiction book starring John Travolta. And of course, as I mentioned, the TV series, The Night Of. This film, this series, stars Andrew Scott as Ripley. You'll recognize him as Moriarty from Sherlock, still available on Netflix, I believe, if you haven't watched that. Very entertaining. Also memorable in an episode of Black Mirror, also on Netflix. Very Netflix heavy here. Became probably most famous recently for playing Hot Priest on Fleabag, for anybody who saw season 2 of Fleabag. And of course, very recently was in award contention for his role in All of Us Strangers, which is available on Hulu right now. I definitely want to have a conversation about that film, a film that I thought was excellent until the end, but features a twist. Once again, I don't want to spoil anything here, but features a twist which I thought was completely unnecessary and hurt the film to a large extent. However, all that being said, Andrew Scott gives an excellent performance in that film. As Dickie Greenleaf, we have Johnny Flynn, a musician turned actor. I have recommended another film here. If you want to just start writing down your recommendations, I will probably put together a letterboxed list of recommendations for this episode, and do check out my letterbox. I'll put, once again, the link in the show notes. It's just easier for me to put everything there. You'll see that I have put movie reviews, things I don't actually cover here on the show, as well as lists and recommendations associated to these episodes. So there's my little advertisement. Do check out Letterboxd. The link is in the show notes once again. It doesn't cost you anything. So yes, the recommendation, Johnny Flynn related. I don't know much that he's done. He actually had a series here on Netflix that was pretty popular when he was much younger. Started as a musician, became an actor. I think he has an interesting energy as an actor. Interesting that he's cast here as Dickie Greenleaf. And I'll get into my thoughts on him once the conversation with Sona begins. But the film I would recommend is a film starring him, but primarily, mainly around Jesse Buckley, who to a large extent emerged with this low-budget psychological horror film called Beast, where I think that Flynn's awkward charisma is probably best used. And I don't want to spoil anything in that film, but you'll have to watch it to know why I think he kind of fits better in that type of role. Anyway, just another recommendation for all of you. Do check out Beast. And features an incredible performance, by the way, Jesse Buckley's performance there, which really launched her whole entire career. And she's, to me, one of the most exciting actresses working today. And also Dakota Fanning here as Marge Sherwood. Also, I got to call out one more technical detail here. This entire series is DP, director of photography, cinematography, however you want to annotate it, by Robert Elswit, who's been working for a very long time. He started off doing special effects work all the way back in early 80s. E.T., for example, just one of the films he worked on of many very large blockbusters he did early in his career. Transitioned into being a director of photography all the way back with Paul Thomas Anderson's first film, Hard Eight. And he stuck with Anderson for quite some time. Anderson is primarily shooting his own films now, but just some really memorable, visually memorable and striking films he's worked on. Punch Drunk Love, PTA, once again, Paul Thomas Anderson. There Will Be Blood, obviously. Anyone who's seen that, you know the incredible images in that film. And he's also become the go-to guy for Dan Gilroy, including another film we've discussed here on the show, Nightcrawler. He's also had a very interesting collaboration with George Clooney, although Clooney is the actor and sometimes just occasionally the producer on some of these films. He has become the cinematographer of choice for most of Clooney's films, most notably Good Night and Good Luck, which Clooney directed, also shot in black and white, which almost certainly is the reason he got this particular project, along with the fact that, of course, he was also Zalian's director of photography in the really strikingly photographed The Night Of, once again, that same series. He's also done several of the Mission Impossible movies, speaking of a Mission Impossible connection, Ben Affleck's movie The Town, and Angelina Jolie's action film Salt, all very visually striking films. So really, he is a total pro, but maybe never more so than he is here with the absolutely stunning black and white photography. Every frame of this film could be a postcard. And that could be a little distracting, to be totally honest with you, but regardless of how it's deployed, I have to say the visuals here are so stunning that I think if you don't enjoy the narrative, you'll probably appreciate the visuals, if nothing else. I watch this movie and I think to myself, why isn't everything shot in black and white? I'm going to desaturate my TV screen and watch everything in black and white. Okay, one more ingredient here before we get into the conversation with Sona. We got to talk about Patricia Highsmith herself, a really interesting character. This book, as dark as it is, was written in 1955 by Patricia Highsmith. She was still in her 20s. Actually, let's go back a step. Came out of college. She had already started writing stories, short stories, sometimes under an alias. She would write lesbian fiction. She was a lesbian, but closeted at the time. You needed to be professionally, but had also started to write thrillers. And she found that she really had a knack for writing thrillers. She kept a diary her whole entire life. So this is all very well documented if you read her diary entries. And after graduating from college, she went to Barnard, actually in New York. She did some advertising work. She worked at Marvel for a little while, actually briefly dated Stan Lee at Marvel and wrote some comics. And then still in her 20s, she wrote Strangers on a Train, and the book became a huge hit. And then she adapted her own book for the Hitchcock movie, which was a huge hit in 1951, I believe, about a year after the book came out. And that made her career. She was basically set for life at that point. About 5 years later, she wrote a book called The Price of Salt. She's still now in her late 20s, let's say. All the women, there's a reason I'm going to get into her personal life here, but all these women that she had affairs with had over time eventually settled down, gotten married, had children. And there was a lot of internalized antagonism and maybe some self-loathing that Highsmith reflects in her diaries. As a matter of fact, at this period of time, she had been recommended by her psychotherapist, recommended that she go to a support group for latent, quote unquote, latent lesbians, women who had started traditional lives and were using the support group as a way to vent their internal struggles. And she did decide to attend this, but primarily in her diaries mentioned that she wanted to seduce some of these women. Now, how much of this is her self-mythologizing or being sarcastic, and how much of it is real, is all open to interpretation. But what is important here is that at this moment in time, she worked part-time when she was still trying to get her finances in order and discover her career path. She worked as a counter girl at a department store, and she interacted with a very glamorous older woman and then fantasized an affair between her and that woman. And that, of course, became the novel, The Price of Salt, which, if that plot sounds familiar, you've probably seen the movie Carol from a few years back, the Academy Award-nominated film featuring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara in those roles. Now, interestingly, her novels from this point on are almost all thrillers and extremely psychologically dark. But in this, not only is it a romance, but there is a happy ending for the protagonists. But there's a dark side to this. In real life, she began to stalk this woman for which she wrote this fantasized plot around her interactions with her. And at one point became so obsessed with her that she started to fantasize about killing this woman. And in her diaries, once again, she describes that she envisioned homicide was a form of lovemaking. So that kind of gives you a little insight into the psychology that she was, or where she was at psychologically at this moment. So I say all this because this is also the same year that she writes the first Tom Ripley novel, known as Mr. Ripley, just Mr. Ripley, or The Talented Mr. Ripley, depending on which edition you have, which of course is the foundation of this entire series we're going to discuss here with you today, the season of the show. She was so obsessed with the Tom character that she began to sign her notes Tom. So she very much, if you have any question in your mind which character in the story she is aligning herself to, she very much sees herself in the Tom Ripley character. And you can imagine that the sexual confusion and the misanthropic view of these characters around her are very much her personal diary entries practically transcribed to a fictionalized storyline. So when doing press following the release of the book, which was very successful at the time, there's actually been multiple sequels, five books, I believe, five Ripley books before she passed away in the 1990s. She had stated that her goal was to, quote, show the unequivocal triumph of evil over good, unquote, but also to not just represent it, but to have the readers, quote, rejoice in it. So the goal is to have us as the reader reluctantly or enthusiastically put ourselves in Tom's shoes and root for him to get away with murder, literally. And of course, the legacy of that is all over prestige TV and pop culture in general. Think about Hannibal Lecter. Think about the series You on Netflix. Think about Dexter, the serial killer who kills other serial killers. And really a generation of films and TV series where we have these moralizing psychopaths that rationalize their behavior that we secretly or overtly root for. And not to mention all of the anti-heroes in our prestige TV, whether that is Tony Soprano or Walter White or a litter of other anti-heroes. Highsmith's diaries also reflect the fact that she was very anti-Semitic, oftentimes racist. She also hated women. She was physically attracted to them, but hated them. She loved the company of men who she found to be intellectually smarter than women. In her assessment, that's not my assessment, but was uninterested in sexual relationships with them, although she sometimes did have them. But she described it in her diaries as kissing a man was like kissing the side of a cereal box. All this is to say she's a very complicated character, but all of this hatred of other people, this misanthropy, this racism, this anti-Semitism, but across the board, not only did she hate pretty much everybody, she hated herself. And I think you see the psychology of this extremely judgmental and yet extremely self-loathing character in all of her anti-heroes, and never more so than in the Ripley character. And I think that's what makes these books still so fascinating to read today. Okay, so let me get into the conversation with Sona. Once again, no spoilers to start things off. Then we will get into spoilers. We'll give you a warning. We get into spoilers in the first three episodes. So if you haven't watched anything, we'll go spoiler-free. And then we will discuss the first three episodes if you've seen only part of the series. And then by myself, I will be back at the end of the episode to break down the final episodes. But more importantly, for me to discuss my own thoughts on the adaptation of this story versus previous adaptations. And I'm always very interested in the press adaptation, what the creator of the show or movie decides to include and exclude. It's more interesting than the story itself, oftentimes, to me. And I will do a little comparison with other Ripley films. All right, Sona. So any Eclipse plans for today?
I am going to pick my son up at the end of the regular school day instead of having him attend the after-school program. And our tentative plan is to watch from right outside our building, which has like a little elevated overpass area, hoping that that will be a good view. How about you?
I mean, I'm picking her up right at the peak of the eclipse, so probably just going to stare directly at the sun. No, just kidding. But
do you have your eclipse glasses?
They gave her some at school. I didn't pick up any for myself. I'm just going to use sunglasses and a pinhole, just basically a pinhole.
Okay. I'm very proud of myself for remembering to order the glasses from Amazon 2 weeks ago.
Good job. Excellent work.
Thank you.
Another apropos of nothing, considering what we're going to be discussing today, I did want to let you know that there is a new episode of Bluey currently available. It's cute, nothing super fancy about it, but all of that is just a little teaser for a 30-minute episode, the longest Bluey episode ever.
Ooh.
Is premiere this week, this upcoming week, so check that out.
Wait, so now Disney is just getting these episodes up one at a time? What's happening?
I don't know why they did the one episode. I guess it's like I don't know if it's a leftover or if it's something from next season that they're previewing, just because, you know, the thing is such a phenomenon now that I guess they're just trying to keep it going. But the 30-minute special was something they've had planned. Obviously, they've probably been producing this for like a year. This is the longest episode they've ever done. So that's been in the works, but I don't know why we got this random new episode other than just to, I guess, as a way to remind people that the special is coming.
Is it something that has already come out in Australia?
No, I think it is a worldwide. This is for the first time, by
wow.
the way. This is a worldwide Disney Plus turning this into a true worldwide brand. So if you are a Bluey fan.
Yeah, I support that. Great,
it's coming.
Let's do it.
I'm always a fan. So. We've already seen the new episode. We just watched it yesterday, actually. And it's cute. Like I said, cute. A haunted, they pretend that the house is haunted when they're trying to sell it. So funny.
Cute.
Okay, Sona. So we are talking about Ripley. I did an intro, which will be before this conversation in the episode itself, where I talk about, you know, Patricia Highsmith. And actually, something I wanted to mention to you, a couple of things. One was, part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation with you about this season of this show, or just this show in general, was because I don't even know if you remember this, but this was originally going to be on Showtime. And probably like some 2 years ago, I was like, oh, since you like the show, when that Ripley show comes out 2.5 years ago when it was originally supposed to come out, we should talk about it. And now here we are years later. It was a Showtime production. You see it right in the title card here. Eventually, I don't know what happened. For some reason, Showtime never put it on the air. And then there were delays with the writer's strike, with the pandemic. So this thing's just been dragging on. And then I think it was probably when we were covering maybe the Dexter reboot or something, I mentioned that, oh, Netflix owns it now. So maybe after you wraps up, they'll put it on the air. And that's probably a year ago at this point. And still now, finally, after all of that, we get Ripley. But a few things. One was that we've discussed it in passing multiple times. Also, it intersects with things we've discussed here on the show. Obviously, Dexter, another sociopath. Your love of the show Hannibal, another very esoteric sociopath, right? A very moralizing sociopath. The show You, all of these shows are basically very indebted to the original Recipe Ripley character. And of course, we have even other connections here in the podcast. We covered the movie Do Revenge, which is loosely based on Strangers on a Train, which of course was written by Patricia Highsmith, also the author of the Ripley novels. And one last thing, of course, we did Dark Water, which is also based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. So we've been circling around the Ripley character and Patricia Highsmith in general on this podcast for a while.
I did not realize all those connections. That's very interesting. And it seems what you have really been saying to me underneath the surface is that I have a bizarre interest in sociopaths, which is probably true. Also,
but aren't we all, given the fact that of all those things I just described that, you know, are very culturally relevant even now, aren't we all, right, basically?
Yes, fair. I'm in good company. And also something that I think we haven't discussed, but that I was reminded of when I was watching these first few episodes is 6 degrees of separation, which is a dated reference probably for a lot of people. I started thinking, like, is there this whole genre of people, of movies about people trying to be fraudulently entering into high society? And I just never really paid attention. Like, it might be its own little subcategory of movies.
Oh, it certainly has, I think. And Ripley, I think, is so foundational to this mythology, but I probably would have to go back and think of some of the, like the Jim Thompson novels, like the film noir type novels from the 1930s and 40s, which probably had a lot of these motifs in it as well. But I think really the idea of like the stylish, sycophantic sociopath, the popular representation of that character, which is all over the cinema of the 80s and 90s and currently, obviously. And not only that, but I think there's something that we could talk about the cultural relevance of this show at this moment. We all have this parasocial sick relationship with celebrities, this love-hate relationship with the super rich. And I think all of that's been there all along, basically. And I think Ripley is an origin story to a lot of that mythology. We just, it's just so in the culture, you don't even think about it anymore, but it's been there for a very long time. So the other reason I wanted to bring this up to you is we have in passing mentioned the 1999, very important year, 1999, by the way, 25th anniversary of The Talented Mr. Ripley with Matt Damon, a very important moment in his career, obviously, and everybody in that film. That year is the year The Matrix came out that year, Fight Club that came out that year, The Sixth Sense came out that year, a huge year for movies in 99. And this one of those movies was The Talented Mr. Ripley, but a movie that you have told me puts you to sleep. So to that point.
I have tried at least 3 separate times to watch that movie. And I swear it's at the same point every time, right after the Philip Seymour Hoffman character is introduced, I cannot keep my eyes open any longer. And it doesn't make any sense to me because I'm interested in the movie. And that's why I tried it 3 times. And somehow my body just shuts down involuntarily every time I try and watch it.
I saw that. I have to tell you that and I'm going to discuss it in greater detail here in the podcast, this adaptation and the previous adaptations, the ones that I've watched, there's some that I haven't watched, but the ones that I have watched and compare and contrast, because I'm very interested, obviously, adaptation is the beats of the plot are nearly identical in these different movies, but what you include, what you exclude, the additional conversations you put in there, the supplemental details are very interesting because it really changes the context of the characters. And that's really interesting to me, like the whole idea of doing that and why you do some of those choices. But all that is to say that in recapping or remembering the details of that film, it's almost a perfect adaptation for large stretches of the novel itself. And yet it didn't really work for me. Yeah, it's incredibly, impeccably made. This is the 99 movie I'm talking about, but it didn't really work for me either. And I saw that in the theater and I have tried to watch it again on cable or whatever. And similarly, I just tune it out. And I don't know why, because just visually, it's so stunning and everybody's so attractive in the film itself. You'd figure you could just, there'd be enough there to keep me engaged, but I do struggle with it. But by the way, one real highlight is I think Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Freddie is really maybe the highlight of that whole entire movie.
Sure. I mean, the one scene I saw, absolutely.
Well, he's only in a few scenes, to be honest.
But I wouldn't know.
The first couple of scenes where he's there, he's really holds the screen and like such a star and such a loss, by the way. Well,
yes, absolutely. It was
just the 10th year anniversary of him passing just a few weeks ago.
I mean, I think also there is just something for me personally about that film noir feel that makes me very sleepy, I will say.
Yes. Well, so that's a good segue here. That is very much one of those sun-drenched noirs, if you could even call it a noir. This very much is leaning into, I'm not sure if this qualifies as a noir for the fact that it just doesn't have some of the components of it. It is very much in the genre of, or I should say, adjacent to noir for sure. But of course, they've decided to make it in black and white. So very much winking at that style of those noir films from the 1930s and 40s. So given everything you just said, Sona, I kind of thought this would also put you to sleep, but it seems like you did like it more than you did the previous version.
So I will say, first of all, I probably don't know the technical definition of film noir. I just think of it as anything with that 1940s kind of feel to it.
Right, right.
So I'm using it very loosely. So I am probably using it incorrectly. But you know what I mean, that feel of those 1940s movies and the way people talk and all of that. They generally are quiet movies compared to what we have now, things that are generally set in the current day. Although Past Lives, also very quiet, brings to mind. But yeah, so obviously I was watching these with the intention of talking about it with you. So that might have given me a little bit of an extra boost. I did find, and we texted about this, it's not only quiet, it's very slow. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely long scenes where I'm kind of like, yeah, I got the message. My very 2024 state of mind, short attention span, let's keep it moving. But I did feel there was enough going on here. And I guess because I never really did watch that first movie all the way through, I didn't feel like I had seen it all. And I already know what's going to happen. So let's hurry up and get to it. Like, I kind of was focusing more on it than I had in the past. So I did enjoy it. What do you think about the decision to make it in black and white? Because in contrast to the Matt Damon movie, which was so beautiful, like sun-drenched, like you said, and the beautiful colors. And this is so beautifully shot that I think, like, gosh, it would be even more breathtaking in color. Yeah. I wonder what this decision was about to do it in black and white.
Yeah, there's going to be a bunch of recommendations in this podcast. And I'm going to start with not only the 99 Talented Mr. Ripley, which, like you mentioned, you don't even need to see the whole movie to get a feel for that. Sona, last night, I just rewatched the trailer. It's one of those trailers that gives away the entire plot of the movie for some bizarre reason. I was trying to remember, in the 99 version, doesn't Matt Damon approach him on the beach? And it's a crowded beach. And when they run into Freddie, aren't they among like a large group of people? So it just seemed like a much more boisterous atmosphere that he's kind of intervening.
Yeah, it was
on
like
this
in a cafe, but like more crowded, right? Yeah.
Exactly. It's a much more kind of like resort area. And I'm like, maybe I'm misremembering. And of course, I watched the trailer and all those scenes are in the trailer. So I'm like, nope, there's a whole bunch of people around. I got everything I needed from watching the trail.
Maybe they didn't have a big budget, so they had to really narrow down the amount of people in this movie. They spent it all on travel.
You could pretty easily get at least another two people on the beach. It was like pretty sparse. So once again, I think very intentional to your point. And also making it black and white is once again a very intentional thing. It's changing the feel of those interactions, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I have a photography degree, and there's a general idea that when you shoot something in color, you're reason you're shooting something in color should be because the colors add something. And to your point, this beautiful locale, obviously in color, is one thing, as opposed to when you shoot in black and white, you are drawing your attention A, to people's expressions and their facial details, and of course, architecturally, to like the lines on the screen. So I can see kind of the intention with the architectural elements and of course, the intimacy of the facial expressions, but I know you only watched the first three episodes. I'm not sure if they're already leaning heavily into the whole Caravaggio parallel, which is something that's been added by this filmmaker.
It's come up several times. They've gone to see some of the paintings.
Yeah. It's very pronounced. Like, they have a whole sequence where Caravaggio is on the lamb. This is a parallel that Zalian has added.
Yes. They talked about this. Yes.
But to that point, the Caravaggio paintings, which are beautiful, even in black and white, are a big part of the plot here. But once again, you're shooting them in black and white. So you're removing a big detail, even from the appreciation of the art itself. So obviously very intentional. So I have the same question you have as to why the decision is made to make this in black and white. But that all circles back to a recommendation I think I have for you specifically that you may appreciate. For me, this is the most entertaining version of the Ripley story. There's a French movie called Purple Noon. It was made in 1960. So it's only 3 years after the first novel was available in Europe. And this is a fictionalized town of Positano, basically, and I believe it was shot in Positano, but in beautiful pastels, incredible colors. And I do recommend it for you, Sona, for two reasons. One is that the visuals are just beautiful to hear this Italian music and the style that you're seeing here, but to hear it in its contemporary time is really great to see, like a true like moment in time. The cast is very attractive, a lot of fun to watch that as a sun-drenched noir in a way, like to your point earlier. And lastly, because it has an ending that's different than the novel and a very entertaining ending. And I do not want to give it away, but especially even if you read the book and because it completely changed it, you're like, boy, I didn't see that coming. And it's a lot of fun. And that's called Purple Noon, by the way. I think it's easily available to stream. Yes.
Cool.
Oh, by the way, speaking of Steve Zaillian, going all the way back to the writer, director of this series, two things. One, I know you do love. He's done a lot of screenplays. He's written for Spielberg, for Scorsese. He wrote the American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He's basically got many Academy Award nominations as a screenwriter. But I have two things for you. One, you've seen, I know if you've seen for sure, which is The Night Of, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Series. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
Same cinematographer, not in black and white, obviously, but beautiful photography of New York in that series. Great performances, yada, yada, yada. But another thing that he's done that I recommend to you is the first film he ever directed and wrote was Searching for Bobby Fischer, which I know your son loves chess. So maybe something to watch with him. Maybe he'd be a couple years older, maybe a couple years old.
Right, right.
Okay, so first things first, what did you think of Andrew Scott as Ripley?
In a way, I'm comparing him to Matt Damon, who, again, my memory of the film is fuzzy. But I feel like it is a grittier take on the character. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think this is the truest to the novel version of Ripley. Ripley is pretty much a sociopath from the get in the book. I think that the Matt Damon version, they are trying to make him a little naive and he becomes more, slips into this sociopathy over the time, of course. But I think you're supposed to be sympathetic towards him, which I do not believe that is the case in the novel. The novel, you are basically rooting for a bad guy. You're not like a bad guy, or I should say a good guy who is fighting for his
in
life
bad
and ends up doing bad
yeah.
things. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. It definitely seems like a harsher portrayal than I was expecting. And this might just have to do with Matt Damon as an actor generally, or maybe it's the take on the character, but less charismatic, right? More like, why are you letting this guy hang around you so much?
Yes.
I didn't really remember questioning in the original, not original, in the Matt Damon version. Let's just call it, I'm going to keep calling it the Matt Damon version.
Yeah, that's fine. I think that's how everybody thinks of it anyway. What's strange about it to me, I'm going to say some really negative things about the show, even though I'm just going to put it out there that over the course of the show, especially after the third episode, I really got into the vibe of the show and I started to understand more of it was trying to do. You having gotten this deep into the show, but I do recommend you finish it. And there is an element where you start seeing these rich people want to hang out with Marge because they know, oh, this tragedy. So they're hangers on. They're kind of bored and there's a lot of negative critique of this generation of wealthy Americans living in Europe at this time. And you see them like starting to enjoy or trying to glom onto these folks because of the celebrity associated to this crime itself, which is something that's not explored as deeply in the book. But regardless, I think that there's something interesting there in its exploration of that. And to your point, how methodical episode 3 is very drawn out for the big sequence that takes place in the middle there or in the whole back half of that episode. And there's a lot of this very procedural stuff that you see, like he's trying to escape eventually, just minor spoilers here, but eventually they're after him for this potential crime. And you see him trying to get from one hotel to the other without being raising any alarms. But then the phone rings and then there's someone at the door. And you see like in minute detail, just how difficult that is for him to just try to escape his circumstance for the moment. So it is very interesting to see that aspect of the series, and it gets more and more into that as the show goes on. So I do recommend it in that regard. But I have some big question marks about some of the decisions in the adaptation itself. Like the black and white, I think it's absolutely stunningly beautiful. I'm not sure if it adds to what the show is trying to say potentially. But the big thing for me is the age of these characters. In my mind, in reading the book and obviously seeing the 99 version of the film, these people are supposed to be like in their 20s. These are people who are like lost after college. And that's another question I have for you. Are we supposed to believe these people are younger than they are? Because these actors are nowhere near 25 years old. That's what I want to...
That's a good question. I think we're supposed to believe they're in their early 30s. That's the sense I get.
But I mean, I think Andrew Scott is 45, 47.
I mean, people did look older in the 1940s. Yes,
this is true. This is true.
Like you always see those memes about like whatever actor was 40 years old when he filmed this movie. And it's like somebody from Cocoon or something, you know, like, I don't know. That's a very specific reference, but I think you know what I mean.
Yes.
Like the Golden Girls are my age now, or, you know, something like that. So I don't know. I think maybe believable as a period piece. They're in their early 30s.
That's how they've aged.
Yes. Smoking, drinking. I don't know. No sunscreen.
Okay. I've been avoiding any explicit spoilers until now, but we're going to spoil. I'm going to ask some of the directed questions about the plot in the first three episodes. I don't know if you want to just do a general recommendation before we get into any spoilers.
No, I mean, so far I'm enjoying it, but only three episodes in, so it's hard to say. But I have stayed awake. It is holding my interest. And I like it. I'm interested to see how after this really critical key event in episode three, what develops next.
So you're committed to finish it, do you think?
I think so.
And to me, before we get into any kind of spoilers, I also recommend do check out through episode three. You may be intrigued by the first couple episodes as to like what direction the show's going in. But I think if you haven't made it to episode three, there's a key moment in episode three, a key event, probably is make or break for whether you want to watch the rest of the show or not. So give it the first three episodes. If you're in on that, then you're going to enjoy the rest of the show, I think. If you're not interested at that point, I don't think you're going to suddenly get into the show. Use that as your own barometer there. Okay, so now I'm going to get into specific questions and spoilers for you. The first thing I want to bring up is, once again, going to the age of the actors. I think it's weird to have aged them up. The book takes place in the mid-50s. This, in the title card, is 1961, and then they flash back 6 months. So it's either the beginning of 61 or maybe even still 1960. So still in the general range of time from the original book. And think about Europe in the late 50s, 1960, et cetera, especially Italy, right? Italy lost World War II, signed the truce in 1947, right? So when the book is written, it's 8 years later. That's something very important to the context of the book. The US's economy has boomed, especially in shipping, right? They like have all the ships, have all the other ships have been sunk all over the world. So they have the only shipping freight. And this person has probably become incredibly wealthy. And a 25-year-old son, disappointed as he is by his son, that he wants him to take over the shipping business. This is Dickie Greenleaf's father I'm talking about here. That he is a 20-something-year-old. He's graduated from college. He, of course, was a child during the war, has no idea what his dad has gone through, has no idea what the country's gone through, as many 20-something-year-olds I can speak to of my nephew, who has no context of what he's describing half the time, but have an expectations. And they want to go and enjoy their lives. They're young. And of course, going to Italy, where a generation earlier, men went to die in a war. And now just a decade later, they're going there to lay about and enjoy the riches of life and have this artistic life, bohemian, beatnik type life, which was very common, by the way, in that generation, like the beatniks before the hippies, obviously like a decade earlier than that. But so that's very important context. You have a 40-year-old actor in there, and let's say even 30-something years old. This is a guy who potentially would have fought in the war 8 years, 10 years earlier. So it's strange to age these characters up. And maybe I'm putting too much emphasis on it, but it did confuse me because I'm trying to think someone even in their 30s would have been intimately familiar with the war. And it's a very different context to me to see a 40-year-old man, you know, deciding to live this way in Europe just a decade after the war ended. I think it's very strange.
Okay. Well, first of all, as you can probably tell from my comments, I was convinced this took place in the 1940s. So I'm just processing all of that now. I guess I did not think about the World War II situation and how that would impact things, because history has never really been my strong suit. And I feel like it has a feel from the 1940s. I'm not sure I understand this show as much, knowing that it's with this realization that it's being set in the 60s.
Just to add to what you're just saying, that just the decision to make this in black and white when this is set in 1961, right? It's strange. It's not like we did not have color film. Like,
yes,
once again,
oh, wait.
Sans Soleil, the Purple Noon, is a film from 1960. It was released in 1960 and has beautiful colors, like beautiful colors.
Yeah, it's weird. I remember seeing that title placard, but I guess I didn't really process it, because even in those New York scenes, which, by the way, also felt very 1940s to me, I was thinking like, wow, this is a very big African-American population in New York City for the 1940s. Which maybe it was. I don't know the statistics. I kind of made a mental note to look it up. The way they were very much a part of those opening scenes wherever he went, it was kind of like, wow, I didn't realize the city was that integrated that early. But that explains that. I don't know. What about Dakota Fanning? What about her age?
I think she is younger, but I wouldn't think it's uncommon for an older man to
agree. Yeah.
The younger woman, especially at that point in time.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that the father-son relationship really makes that much sense either if he's older, because at that point you think your parent would have just written you off. If it hasn't happened yet, it's not going to happen. And like, rather than orchestrating this whole thing to get him to come back home, that seems like a weird thing to do for someone who is approaching middle age.
That actor, by the way, who I did not think gave a very good performance, but I want to call out that that is Kenneth Lonergan, the screenwriter and the playwright who wrote, has written multiple movies and plays, including Manchester by the Sea, by the way, also directed it. But I do not think he's a very good actor.
The dad?
Yes, the dad.
Dad? Does. Yeah, okay.
Not a very good actor, by the way. I hate to say it.
Yeah, I feel like the story only makes sense to me if these people are in their early 30s at the oldest.
Exactly. They have to be post-college. And that's the other thing that's strange. Tell me if you have a different read on this, but how did they even find Tom? Because I'll let you know something about the book, that Tom is very much like the Tom Ripley we see here. He's just running scams in New York.
Yeah.
But unlike this, or maybe it's in implicit here as well, he may not have even gone to college. We don't know anything about his biography. He's basically just a cipher. We do not know anything about his past other than everything he says is pretty much a lie. So we're not certain of what of it is possibly true and what is not. And he ends up going to a party. He tries to hang on and get his way into these upper crust parties just to feel like a person, I guess. And that's hinted at earlier on. And he borrows a jacket. And this is the same in the book, by the way. I mean, this is the same in the film adaptation, the 99 one, that he borrows a jacket because it's cold. He grabs a Princeton jacket, which is actually Tom's jacket. They end up being at the same party. And then what happens is that the dad eventually sees him wearing this jacket and assumes, oh, my son went to that school, graduated that year. So maybe you know him. And then he just says, oh, yeah, I know him, right? Which makes a lot of sense in that regard, that he's obviously a con man. He has an opportunity to go to Europe.
Yes.
Great. In this regard, yes, we have the same biography that he's just this con man. But then he has a private investigator locates him, which assumes that he does have an actual relationship.
Yes,
with,
it was very unclear.
Isn't
yes.
that very strange and very confusing choice to make that detailed change? Because it doesn't tell us, once again, it just confuses the plot, I think, in some way.
It was very unclear. And he mentions, when they meet on the beach, we met at so-and-so's party.
Right.
And then Dickie says, oh, I don't remember that. But then when they get introduced to Freddie, Freddie says, I know you from that party.
Right, right.
And it just added more confusion for me
right.
as to like whether he really was at this party or not and what's happening. Yeah, I think they needed just a couple of throwaway lines of exposition there to establish why the private investigator would conclude that they knew each other.
Yeah, especially because it's so well delineated in the original text that it's just serendipity. He borrows this jacket.
Yeah.
It's a mistaken identity. And then, of course, Freddie immediately, at this point in the novel and in the that previous film, that when Freddie shows up, he really throws a wrench in the works because he's ingratiated himself with Dickie. And then he's like, yeah, remember him from school? Because Tom mm-hmm. has like been, oh, I was that guy. Remember that guy? You do that thing where you created memories in the person's mind. And Freddie's like, this is all baloney. So this third party had like really throws a wrench in this. So instead of being like, no, we met at this party. And yes, they actually did. And not only that, that the father would be looking at all the possible people he could send. And this guy, like, how do they even know he's in the same social circles? Like, because they went to a party at the same time? Like all of that seems very odd.
Yeah, I agree.
And confusing. Yeah. Needlessly confusing.
I mean, they did have a throwaway line that like they had approached other people and not yes. gotten any takers.
He's
so this was like
one.
The bottom
yeah, exactly.
of the barrel. But it still doesn't explain how that came to exist.
Yeah. Theoretically, it would be that maybe we are talking about the same party that exists in novelization and they literally knew everybody who was there and started tracking them down. Maybe. But that's quite a stretch.
Yeah. Agree.
This person who plays Freddie, by the way, the non-binary, so they
right.
use the they pronouns. By the way, I don't know if you knew this, Stings and Trudy's one of their children.
I knew that because I just read it in a headline online.
That's the only reason
the
I knew
day.
As well.
Yes.
Yes.
But I definitely see the similarity. What I knew that before I watched it, and it was actually like the connection to me was very clear.
Yes. After the fact, I was like, oh, yes, I see the connection.
Yeah.
Not a great Freddy for me, I got to say. What did you think?
I mean, I assume we're going to see more of this character.
You haven't seen enough of the character yet, I would say. A striking person, obviously, but I'm, once again, maybe unfairly comparing it to Philip Seymour Hoffman, who I think like steals every scene he's in the original film. So it's tough. But a more important character as the series progresses, obviously, once, okay, we're full spoiler territory here. Episode 3, the big thing is that Tom kills Dickie on the boat. Same as in the book, same as in the previous adaptations. That event is always pretty much the same across all adaptations.
Just to go back for a second, there's something about, I'm still processing this being in the 1960s and how I missed that. But the feel of this movie to me, like everyone has a stilted delivery. So I didn't consider Freddy's any more stilted than everybody else's line readings. And while I was watching it, it's kind of like, is that how people talked back then with no filler words whatsoever? Nobody ever says or ah or I mean, I know the idea of saying like is very recent, right? That we use that as a filler word so often now. But everybody is just speaking in the shortest possible sentences and nobody interrupts each other. Nobody overlaps with each other. Nobody. I mean, it's just very weird to me.
Very written.
Yeah, right. In a book, it would make sense, I suppose. But in a movie, I mean, this is part of the reason, you know, I'll often joke about my unrefined taste in movies. And I'll say, I don't want to watch anything set in the past. But part of the reason is because they talk like this and it bothers me. I don't find it natural.
Well, they're all British actors also playing Americans, which, except for
they're focusing so hard on the accent.
Work on the accent so clearly. Yeah. I do want to talk about the, once again, a change from the novel, which I don't understand. It's making me ask questions I shouldn't be asking, unfortunately. And it's a big one. Why does Dickie take Tom out on that boat? And why does he stop it and have that conversation with him in such a vulnerable point? It seems so, once again.
How did this happen in the Matt Damon version? I couldn't remember. This is actually, strangely, right around where I fall asleep.
Yes, that is a weird place for you to
yeah.
It is similar to it the way it is in the book. So in the book, let me just go back to that. In the book, Dickie has a tendency to fall in love with his friends. And he's very strange change here, by the way. I feel that, let me just focus on this one performance. I think that Johnny Flynn's performance as Dickie doesn't work for me. I think it's a big problem with the film.
Okay.
Because unlike, for me, the Jude Law character, and I'm not a huge fan of... What's her name?
Gwyneth Paltrow
in general, but I really do like her in that film. And the idea that he is in this, these two people who are madly in love and they're like beautifully blonde and tanned and the colors of that place, you could imagine him falling in love with the place, falling in love with them, and just being in the sun and warmth of these beautiful people. He's so pale in that movie as well, although he, you know, gets tan over the course of the film, obviously. But it's this contrast to who he is and how he's attracted to that. And then all of a sudden he starts feeling that this son, this that he's getting from the Jude Law character, Dickie, is fading. Like he's kind of losing interest in him, which is a pattern he finds out from other people. Well, yeah, once he gets bored with you, he kind of moves on to the next person. And he's feeling that that's happening and he's going to get cut off. They're basically going on this trip. And this is for them to have like a one last trip together and have a blast. Same thing in the book, by the way. But during the trip, he's going to give him the bad news that, you know what? You're too clingy and I just don't want this anymore, right? And it's kind of like breaking up with a friend on that trip. And that's the plan. And and there's some differences between the book as far as Marge. Marge in the book, very much like this, doesn't like Tom at all. In the movie, Gwyneth Paltrow actually very sympathetic to Tom and is like, don't break his heart. Don't be too hard on him. They've actually become very close in a way. They even remain close after the murder, as opposed to in the book where Marge is just like, I don't like that guy. Get rid of him as soon as possible, right? Which is more like what we saw in this adaptation.
Yeah.
But all that is to say that it is that he knows that he's going to basically be dumped and that he's going to lose this lifestyle because he doesn't have his own money. Yeah. It's just Dickie splurging on him. And he starts to think, what if I just take over his life, right? I do not want to go back to being this miserable rat in New York City. and he decides to kill him. There's also definitely sexual tension. I want to talk about that because it's different. It's different adaptations. But there's some overt or subversive sexual jealousy there as well. But he decides the only way to keep things going is to take over, imitate Dickie, which he's already started to do. That happens in the book as well when he like dresses like him, starts imitating his voice, and he catches him doing it. It happens in all the adaptations once again. So all of that also creeps out Dickie as well. So he starts to see himself in the role of imitating him. Dickie could do it better. And it's pretty cold-blooded. In the film, they try to make Tom more sympathetic across the board. And in that case, Dickie actually is insulting him, is mocking him, is saying, you know, you're such a loser. You're such a, you know, hanger-on. Don't you see how people treat you? He's basically overtly bullying him and telling him that, and he already knows that he's getting sick of him. Same basic rationalization, but he is physically slapping him in the boat, being like, why don't you fight back? Why don't you do something? So he's really like goading him. And then he hits him with the oar the first time. And it's a great sequence, by the way, hits him with the oar. And then you see Jude Law just turns around and looks at him. And then all of a sudden, just blood starts pouring from the scalp. And at first, you don't even think he's hit him that hard. And it's a really shocking moment. It's really well done. And then, of course, he actually gets assaulted by Jude Law. He starts fighting him in the boat. And then he just keeps beating him until he kills him. But it's almost like an accidental or even self-defense at the end. Potentially, you could read it as self-defense when Jude Law starts to attack him.
So, your question is the same then for any version of this. Why are they out on this boat alone? Or is it just in this version?
Well, it's Dickie's wants to take him out on this boat. And then they start getting into, in one case, an argument. The other one is completely premeditated. What's strange about this one, I'd say specifically, is that he takes the boat, right? And it is Dickie's choice, basically. Although I think maybe Tom suggests it here. I forget exactly the details. But they go out on this boat together. And then he stops the boat. And he reads the letter from his dad, which is not in the original versions, by the way. The dad is not the one who's on to Tom. So he stops there to like say, this is what my dad told me. Let me read this to you. And then he has this whole thing in the middle of the ocean being like, so I'm cutting you off and I'm telling you now. Once again, the plan with the previous version was that they're going to have like a guy's weekend away and he's going to break the bad news to him over the course of that. And Tom just happens to know ahead of time. So that's relatively the same across these. But I'm just talking about the logistics of the moment of being like, I know this guy's going to get really upset when I give him this news. So I'm going to take the boat into the middle of nowhere, cut the engine and have this conversation with him. I'm just talking about that moment, the decision. It just makes no sense to me at all. It's just it's so stagey, basically, right?
The only thing that I could think of is there's some comment, and I can't remember the context of it, about how he's afraid of water and he's not a good swimmer. And do you remember that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if it was true.
If it's true. I agree.
Yeah. He said that he told him that. I assume he did. But I don't know that maybe he would feel more vulnerable in the ocean. But then I question, given what happens with the boat after that, I question whether any of it is true, because he did fine considering ridiculous circumstances that almost seem like slapstick comedy to me. So maybe trying to capitalize on making him uncomfortable by being in the water.
You know what? This is my read on it in the moment. And then I forgot this, but now I'm circled back to it by the time we get to the end. Honestly, when I watched this the first time and he pulls out that letter, because I knew it was going to happen, obviously, I've read and seen multiple versions of the story. And also because, unlike other versions of Dickie, Johnny Flynn is not playing him as this charismatic guy. He's playing him as a depressive who's not good at anything he's trying to be good at. Mm-hmm. And people start reading that maybe he's suicidal, which, by the way, is the same kind of rationale that plays out in the other adaptations as well. But I started to think maybe that's not Tom making that up. Maybe this guy is suicidal. I actually thought that because I just felt like he seemed depressed. And of course, the tone of the show, the show itself, is a little depressed, to be honest.
Yeah.
And then when he stops it and he like basically goads Tom with the letter, I honestly was watching this though going like, does he want Tom to kill him?
And interesting.
No, I'm not sure I was wrong in that read at that moment, right? Because if you're going to break the bad news to somebody, do you, you know, especially if you think maybe they're erratic, he doesn't seem to believe that, but Marge has been wary of him. And once again, I'm bringing the context of the other adaptations where in the book, for example, Marge specifically says he's dangerous. Be careful with him, right? So I'm bringing all that in with my read to this as well. But would you put yourself out in the middle of nowhere And is that where you decide to break the news? I don't know. That seems a little odd to me, unless it was intentional. Maybe he truly was depressed and some of what is said about him after the fact is maybe true.
I was questioning it as well, which is why I went to that idea of him being scared of water and being a bad swimmer, that maybe he thought somehow it was going to give him the upper hand, because that was the only way I could make it make sense.
It's a very odd choice. You can just wait until you make it to the island. Like there's no reason.
Together. Yeah.
There's no rush in breaking out that letter on the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like giving him a perfect moment to act.
Yes, I agree.
I do like very much though, in this moment, and we see it throughout the rest of the film, how it really goes into the nitty gritty of how hard it is to do some of these things that we take for granted in your traditional Matlock episode or something where everything is neatly resolved in 15 minutes. It's that killing this guy is really hard, right? He can't even get the anchor removed. He has to burn part of the boat to get the anchor off. And then he tries to sink him. And then he accidentally knocks himself out of the boat. And then he gets back, he smashed in the back of the head, the anchor. And it's just like one disaster after another, which is also comedic in its own way. And
laughed out loud. Yes.
There is a lot of comedy. I think there's a lot of very subtle comedy in this as well. I love everyone's reaction to seeing Dickie's art. It's always great.
Yeah.
Wait till you see this investigator in the next episode, the investigator who's a big character in all of the adaptations. There's this cat and mouse between Tom and this Italian investigator who's pursuing him. And he also goes to interview all the suspects. And every time he encounters Dickie's artwork, it's very funny. And I love when he talks to Marge, and Marge goes, well, you know, he was here to do some art. And he's like, yes, his art. It's great. Every time they refer to his art, it's really funny. I like how Tom can't really hide his disdain for neither the bad artwork or for Marge's writing. And then you see, even beyond that, you see him trying to dispose of the boat, right? Very badly, by the way. I do like this. Oftentimes in these shows, the killers are somehow super adept at cleaning up after themselves or whatever. And in this regard, you see how he thinks the boat, he doesn't even sink it enough to, you know, hide the motor, the top of the motor. But not only that, if you've been to these waters around Italy, anybody on the cliff can see a submerged boat. You can see straight through to the bottom of the bay.
Yeah. It was like, weren't you paying attention to what happened with the fire the first time? Like when set the entire boat on fire the first time, there is no reason for you to believe you would have a different result 10 minutes later. I mean, yes, a little bit more gasoline or whatever. Maybe you're not thinking clearly in those circumstances. I felt like I was a little bit unclear whether it was supposed to be intentionally comedic or not, but I did find it very funny, all of it.
Oh, no, I very much think it's supposed to be intentionally, like watching movies or something, right? Oh, that's all you have to do. And it's just like, that's not how boats work. These boats have been around for, you know, decades. Not going to just catch up like Tinder. So now, I think we pretty much covered the most pressing things that happened in those first three episodes.
I'm looking forward to see how it develops. I'm looking forward to visually see, because this is a beautiful show, exactly what they do, especially because now we've really reached a part where I have no familiarity with the storyline any longer. We've exhausted the point to which I was able to stay awake. So yeah, it's going to be a new story for me. I'm interested in it. And I think you had mentioned maybe watching it at a slightly faster speed. So I might look into that.
Yes. I watched most of these episodes at 1.25 speed, full disclosure, after maybe the third episode. I think I probably watched most of them at 1.75 speed, unless I forgot to turn it back on again, by the way. There were definitely sections I watched at normal speed. But I will tell you that oftentimes when I forgot or enabled the 1.25 speed and disabled it, I really couldn't tell the difference. So if you decide to do the same thing, or if you do that pretty regularly, this is a show you really won't notice you're going at 1.25 speeds. And the visuals, yes, you're going to see them in Rome. You're going to see different locales, beautifully shot. Most of these on location in this incredible black and white, just some of the architecture. I really want to travel to some of these locales. It's just stunning to see where they go. Oh, one thing I did want to touch on is the sexuality aspect to this series, which I guess I won't talk too much in detail here because it does spoil some things later on. But just to say that it's interesting that the sexuality of the characters is in all of the adaptations to some extent, even in that 1960 adaptation, although it's more subversive, which also is the case for the book written in 1955. But Patricia Highsmith was a lesbian and she, if anything, associated herself with the character Tom. As a matter of fact, a little creepy here, but not only did she stalk somebody, she has thousands of pages in a diary and she talks about stalking someone. And describing, fantasizing about killing them and thinking of it as a form of lovemaking, by the way. So a mentally ill woman, apparently. But she also signed her personal letters Tom. So if you had any question who she associates herself to in these characters, Ripley is definitely her surrogate in these stories. So obviously she dealt with some of these questions of her own sexuality as well. So that is definitely subtext in the original book, nothing overt, but definitely more overt in every one of these adaptations. So interesting that they added it. I don't know if being overt about some of these things makes it more interesting. I think leaving it more subversive is more interesting to me personally, but it is interesting that they make this a key point in the plot multiple times. And I don't know if you want to go back, circle back to that point about the possible attraction between Tom and Vicky.
There's that one really funny time that I can't remember the context, but Tom says, "I like girls," in the most unconvincing way possible.
It was like the taxi scam. That was hilarious, by the way. The girl's literally 2 feet away from the taxi. It's very, very
yes.
funny.
So, I mean, I think it's interesting, and it is something that, whether it were the 1940s or, in fact, reality is the 1960s, I think is very true to that time of discomfort with any kind of open discussion of that, even when it is known to exist. I also liked on the beach where the guys are making the pyramid, and Dickie explains these are gay guys, and he goes, "So what? It's still impressive."
It's still impressive. Exactly.
So I think it's an interesting narrative thing that's going on there that feels very true to that period.
You'll see even more of it as you go through the series, but there are multiple times when it's implied, once again, not from the original text, but very much here, that one of the reasons that Dickie might be on the lam and might have become suicidal over time might be him dealing with his sexuality. There are times when they never say it. They just go like, because you know what they said about him, you know. Just like this implied that the you know means something that is never overtly said because it's just something that's never spoken of. Yeah, and maybe we'll touch base again when you see the rest of the show.
Yeah.
And you can have a couple more things I wanted to mention before we wrap up. Another reason that people may be interested in seeing this Ripley show, which is popular, by the way, and getting good audience scores. I thought audiences might dislike it. The critic scores are pretty high. Audience scores are pretty high. A little surprised by that. I thought people might lose their patience with a show that's so deliberately paced, let's say. But also Saltburn. So Saltburn was a mild hit at the box office around Christmas time. And then after it had only been out of theaters for a few weeks and had been doing pretty well, they released it on Amazon Prime and it became a huge, huge success on Amazon Prime. The song that's used in the final credits became a top 40 hit for the first time ever. It was like the song from the early 2000s that was it A Murder on the Dance Floor, I think it was called. Anyways, it was a phenomenon basically on streaming. All that is to say that it is very indebted to the Ripley story. But I do recommend it to you because it verges on camp. It is a lot of fun, where this one is very dour, to be honest. And that one doesn't fully work for me either, but it is definitely interesting and you'll definitely remember having seen it. Let's say that. So it has its moments. But that is a very entertaining version of the story if you'd like to see it from a very different perspective. It's not beat for beat, so don't feel like, oh, I've already seen Ripley. I've seen that story. It's, you know, significantly different, but obviously inspired once again by the character of Ripley. So one more possible connection for everybody. Seek out. And that's Saltburn. It's still available on Amazon Prime. And yeah, finish this one out, Sona. And maybe we'll get final word on that in our next conversation. All right. Thanks again for the conversation.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. So that was my conversation with Sona. She will be finishing the rest of the series or the season. If this is successful, and maybe this is why they cast someone older, there may very well be adaptations of the following subsequent Ripley books as well. I'm going to spoil the rest of the season of the show beyond the murder of Dickie and give you some of my thoughts on that as well. As I already touched on here, I find it strange that they came up with this alternate version of how Tom would have had any association with Dickie. And it's hard for me to believe that these actors are supposed to be in their 20s, maybe even early 30s. They're off by 10 years or more, which once again is problematic, even in someone in their 30s, when you consider that Italy, even, let's see, 1961 is 14 years out of the war. So someone in their early 30s would have been a teenager during the war. So maybe, maybe, but it does seem a little odd. And a change in the adaptation that doesn't necessarily add anything to the read of the material. Okay, huge plot contrivance here for me. We have this very entertaining cat and mouse chase that plays out between this very charismatic, interesting actor who I've never seen before playing the investigator here. But interesting, one of the things that I think works really well here is how this crime is happening in plain sight, how the forensics of the current time would have never allowed this to happen, obviously. And that obviously is very intentional. This could have only happened where you're using someone's signature, someone's typewriter as a fingerprint to identify them. And of course, that just mopping up some blood off the hardwood floor is enough to cover up a murder scene where now, of course, forensics would have identified blood all over that apartment, especially when you consider Freddie's murder, for example. So all of that is fun, setting it in this time period before this happens. The choice of black and white is strange, probably a wink at, let's say, some of these Italian classics like The Bicycle Thieves or La Dolce Vita, all shot in black and white, of course, and also late 50s, early 60s for those films. And maybe the most contemporary aspect of this is not only Ripley's love-hate relationship with the wealthy people around him, something that I think culturally has become just a sport nowadays, our fascination with these rich people that we claim to hate, but do we really? And it does explore that in a very subtle way. I think it's very clever in how they explore that theme, oftentimes just the framing of a character's face. The addition of the Caravaggio and it's his history as a murderer that was traipsing around Europe as well, very much parallels Tom's story. And that's interesting, an addition here from Zalian, not in the original text. And lastly, I also like the fact that everybody has their own bias. Even this really intelligent police officer, honestly, just because he refuses to listen to the hysterical woman, Marge, could have probably cracked the case and caught Tom if he didn't have his own biases in ignoring her testimony. So I do like the fact that everybody's blind in a slightly different way. Marge is fixated on the fact that Tom didn't love her or maybe was gay, and that's why he wasn't in a relationship with her, wasn't willing to commit to her. And that becomes her prism in which she sees the events playing out. Dickie, for example, doesn't see the scam of the girl in the taxi ride, and yet can see the mafioso, sees the risk of that immediately. And this is across the board. Everybody has a certain blind spot and misses what is right in front of their face because of their own pre-assumptions or their own prejudices, which does lead me to something that I think is intentional and thematic and yet a huge plot hole, that this super adept, dogged investigator never sees a photograph of Dickie under any other circumstances. I would buy this hook, line, and sinker. Someone said, I saw the guy. Someone said he signed his paperwork. Someone says that's his signature. Someone said that's his typewriter. And the reality is 90% of us would simply say, yep, I have a story that's convenient to my beliefs, so therefore, I'm in accordance. I got it. But this woman, Marge, is writing a book about her experiences with Dickie and has photographs everywhere. She is a photographer, not a great one, but regardless, there are photos everywhere. And if he had simply said, please give me photos of all the main players here so I can stick them up on my corkboard, this whole thing would have been cracked long before. And that is a little bit of a one contrivance that I find a little too convenient. So do send me an email, needsomeintroduction@gmail.com. Tell me if these plot holes annoyed you, irritated you, detracted from the film, or maybe I'm misreading these things and you have a more elegant or charitable way to read some of these things that I see as plot holes. And check in later this week. I'll be having a conversation about the films of Alex Garland and then reviewing his new film, Civil War, which is coming out on Friday. Oh, and of course, check out my letterbox list attached to this, to the show notes of this episode, where I have all of those recommendations for other Ripley-adjacent films and TV series you might want to check out. I'll talk to you soon.